I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Time now for Food Friday. Our next guest has written a guide about the 50 foods he thinks every modern gourmet must know, with an emphasis on tradition and simplicity.
He says knowing good food is part of a complete understanding of the world, and it's necessary for living a good life.
Joining us now is Ed Baer. He's the founder of The Art of Eating and the author of 50 Foods, The Essentials of Good Taste. Ed, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, you said that knowing good food is part of a complete understanding of the world. It's necessary for good life. Why?
Why? Oh, boy, put me on the spot. I think, you know, good food eating, deliciousness is about sensuality. And I think that's a part of life that maybe the Puritans up here in New England haven't always embraced, but I think it's important. You don't really understand the natural world, for instance, without a feeling for the senses, and food is a huge part of our experience of the senses.
Well, this new book of yours, it looks at the top 50 foods, well, not top 50, but the 50 that you feel are essential. How did you pick these?
Well, you know, everybody wants me to say that they're the best foods or my absolute favorite foods. But if I just chose those, there might not have been any balance. I mean, I don't know. I love cheese. So maybe there'd be 49 cheeses plus butter or something, which is perfect.
That would sell in Wisconsin. Yeah.
We're dairy states. So they're foods that I love, but I wanted to have, you know, I wanted to have lettuce. I wanted to have green beans. I wanted to have beef. I wanted to have caviar and a few unusual things. I wanted chocolate. So I love all those foods, but there is a bit of a distribution.
And as part of this, that, you know, these are often kind of foundational foods. You know, for instance, we'll be talking about eggs today, and eggs go into lots of other yummy dishes, desserts and custards and omelets and souffles and all that kind of thing.
For sure. No, they're kind of, I mean, as I've written about it, they're really, they're architecture. They're the foundations for so many other things, and they're delicious in themselves. And they produce so many textures, really luscious textures sometimes.
Well, we picked three to talk about. We couldn't possibly cover all 50, but I think we picked three good ones. We've got beef and eggs and chocolate. Let's start with beef, because that's something that Americans have been eating for a long time. What do we need to know about beef?
Well, beef, the bad news for me, from my perspective, is that the beef in supermarkets has been going downhill a bit over time. The cattle are slaughtered younger, less care is taken all along the way. The good news is that, of course, meanwhile, at farmers' markets and at different other sort of less mainstream stores, the quality of meat in general, and it's certainly led by beef, has been going up, so that there's really delicious, flavorful beef out there. And for me, yes, you can have really delicious, totally lean beef, but for me, and I think most Americans, the beefiest taste has some kind of a balance between fat and lean, between flavorful fat, and sometimes we hear that, I don't know, all the flavor in meat is in the fat, but that's not true. There's also very flavorful meat, especially when the cattle have been raised partly out on pasture and outdoors, so you get really flavorful so-called, you know, free-range cattle. Range is, of course, the key word in the past.
Right. Well, and there has been some debate over what cattle should eat for the most flavorful beef. And, you know, it seems as though the trend had been to feed cattle, you know, corn or sometimes grain and not grass. Where do you come down on the grass, corn?
A little bit in the middle. Certainly you want a lot of grass, and the corn feeding isn't even all that old. I mean, it's decades old, but it's not sort of the primordial way of raising cattle. And as my position, and it's not perhaps the most scientific one, but is that a certain amount of corn isn't so harmful for cattle, and so finishing cattle on corn isn't up to a point, isn't all that bad. But you can finish cattle and get a very rich marbled meat on grass. It just has to be really rich grass.
How do you have rich grass?
You have rich grass. You have to, it has to be the right time of year. You have to live in a climate that has good rainfall, and Wisconsin would qualify. You have to have a well-managed pasture, for instance, because I'm more familiar with pasture being here in the East, that is allowed to regrow. I mean, if you just let the pasture be untended, tall grasses aren't so good. You want them at a certain height. At that point, they're the richest in nutrition, that sort of thing.
It's interesting to me that in France, it sounds like where you consider sort of beef central, they really know how to produce good beef. The cattle aren't slaughtered till they're five, some of them, or 7 years old.
Well,
and here,
that's more historical than good economics for the present. I was really talking about a prime point of reference.
Ideally, we would be able to do
this. Something
but...
over 20 months. There's no firm age. It depends, of course, on that. The flavor depends a lot on breed. It depends upon the way it's raised. I don't know, even time of year, diet, of course, as we've been talking about. So there are multiple factors. But it takes a certain amount of time for a plant to accumulate flavor and also for an animal.
Now, at the end of each entry, you give sort of suggestions about how to prepare the ingredient and what goes well with it in terms of wine and complementary ingredients. What do you suggest with beef?
Oh, boy, all kinds of things. Now you scare me that I'll contradict what I've written, but I'm a big fan of anything onion. Roasted onions are good. Roasted root vegetables, very good at this time of year. If you go in a completely different direction, you know, you could have a béarnaise sauce with tarragon. Cognac, even in the sauce, kind of enriches it, going in an extreme there. But there are all kinds of other things, and, you know, they don't have to be rich and heavy. There can, you know, a lettuce leaf under a grilled steak is super classic and super good.
All right, well, let's move on to something especially yummy, timely with all of us eating candy for leftover from Halloween, chocolate. What comes to your mind when you think about what makes truly excellent chocolate?
Well, it's kind of that there are almost two kinds of chocolate in the world, at the risk of oversimplification. One is the chocolate almost every one of us, probably every one of us, grew up on, which are familiar names that we won't mention here at the moment. And there's nothing wrong with them, and they make people happy. But there's a kind of a second sort of chocolate, and it really has to do with the quality of the beans and the trees they come from, that has much more fruit flavor, even floral flavors you can find in it. So those combined with roasting flavors and bitterness to create a full chocolate flavor. And those, for me, are more interesting, especially the fruit and flower components. I mean, people talk about chocolate almost the way they talk about wine, and maybe it's a little tedious, but, you know, cherries, different things, you know, orange, different things that people think they taste in that chocolate. And for me, that's a much more interesting experience.
Now, you're talking mostly about dark chocolate here, which it sounds like is your partial to. It sounds like you don't really want to waste your time with milk chocolate.
No, it's kind of true.
And I won't even get you started on white chocolate. But
yeah, no, I think I wrote that was one of, in the whole book, I think that was one of almost the only things that I just say are abominable. But perhaps it's a matter of taste.
All right, well, you talk about a process for chocolate that I was unaware of, conching. Mm-hmm. And apparently it's, you know, not controversial, but it's a choice chocolatiers make about whether to conch or not to conch. Can you tell us what that is?
That's true. In years past, they would, in Europe, for instance, it's very typical to conch it. It's a refining process, and they don't even completely understand what goes on. But it's textural. It has to do with flavor, and they used to conch for even several days. Now it's a matter of hours, and there's some, you know, very fancy chocolates that will even tell you just how long they were conched. A chocolatier that I talked to, who's in Massachusetts, says that when he conches and he goes home at the end of the day, his wife can smell just how strong it is because there are off flavors that come out. And what this process is, it's a machine. The original one was shaped like a shell, thus conch. And it just basically turns the chocolate over and over. It's just constantly keeping it in motion. And that goes on for, as I say, hours and perhaps occasionally still a few days.
Interesting. Okay, well, we got to get to eggs, but last question. You say chocolate kills wine. So what do you do if you want to have chocolate and wine?
What you do? Well, you could go for more alcoholic beverages, meaning, you know, certain fortified wines, and also particularly not a great Bordeaux, but something with strong, intense flavors, and they're oxidized wines. For instance, certain strong, sweet sherries that have been aged for a time, not necessarily expensive. And then there's a wine that I especially like called Banyuls from the south of France in the Mediterranean just by the French border, and another one from the same place called Mauri. And you can get a Mauri that's not too expensive. And those can have just their sweet flavors. Somehow there's enough alcohol and sugar to stand up to the chocolate and enough intensity of flavor, and you get some really special combinations with chocolate.
But in general, you've got a really expensive wine. Don't waste it with your chocolate.
That's really true.
Okay, so what about eggs? Obviously fresh is good, right? Should you go for the freshest egg you can find?
Yes, I would say without doubt, except for the notion that a super fresh egg is harder to peel if you want to peel the boiled egg.
And are you partial to the different eggs? I don't know. Since I've been frequenting farmers markets more frequently, and they're so beautiful, some of these eggs and the pastel hues. They look like little pastels from Impressionists or something. Do you have a favorite kind of egg?
No, I don't. I have to say, I don't think that more beautiful eggs necessarily taste better, although I used to always get blue ones, and they were really wonderful, and I began to associate the blueness with better taste. But I think the science is that it's much more the way the chickens are raised, whether they're outdoors, whether the eggs are fresh, what they're fed, that makes much more difference than the breed, like Rhode Island Red or one of these fine old familiar names.
In our last 20 seconds or so, what is your favorite thing to do with eggs?
Oh gosh, I think a souffle. I think just because everyone else says they fall so easily and I can make them rise without trouble, I just like to make souffles.
Wow, I wish we could make you come here and prove that. That sounds fantastic. Well, Ed, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
We've been talking to Ed Baer, the author of 50 Foods, The Essentials of Good Taste.